Good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in our sixth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, and with help from Haiwan Wan, our website and virtual library coordinator. Our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is a native of Columbia, South Carolina, and as a child, he grew up wanting to be a historian and folk musician. He was influenced by his grandparents' love of history, reading, and the music of the 1960s. After completing high school, he received a BA in religious studies from the University of South Carolina and a Master of Library Science from the University of Maryland. He served on the library faculty at the Universities of Virginia, Cincinnati, and Missouri before joining WKU in 1998. As coordinator of collection services. Multi-talented, Jack is a frequent speaker on topics in librarianship and conflict management, and has conducted seminars nationally on emotional intelligence. In 2005, his book on conflict management for libraries was published by the American Library Association. Jack's also a professional musician and songwriter, plays the guitar, the harmonica, and the Appalachian dulcimer, and has released three albums. The most recent as part of the folk duet Shadow Dancer entitled Tradition with a Twist in March of 2008. While studying in South Carolina, Jack became fascinated with folk healing and magical beliefs, and this fascination led to several decades of research, oral interviews, and meetings with root doctors and traditional healers in the Lowcountry and Piedmont areas of South Carolina and later Virginia and Pennsylvania. The end result was this new book, American Shamans, Journeys with Traditional Healers, published this year by Buska Press in New York. It's my great pleasure to introduce our very own Renaissance man, Jack Montgomery, to talk about the traditional healers.
Thank you. Thank you for that nice introduction, Brian. Thanks for coming about this book. This book is a book that took 30 years to write. Not because I write slowly, but because I didn't have a book contract and I just kept researching and couldn't stop. I hopefully tonight take you on a little journey that won't tire you, but will also give you a little something to think about, a little inspiration perhaps. I've always, as Brian pointed out, lived several lives at the same time. And this is a little part of a life that's always been secret in life. Life, nobody really asked, and I never said, which is traditional. But this is something I finally realized I needed to talk about, and I wanted to talk about, so the book developed out of that. I want to start by reading a couple things to you. This is from Gordon Wilson Sr., if that rings any bells. He wrote The Folklore of the Mammoth Cave Area, and I quote him, "Every community had one or more grannies or herb doctors who knew how to treat minor illnesses with their teas and tonics, their plasters and poultices, their sage warnings about what to do and what to avoid. Healers were called herb doctors, rubbing doctors, blood stoppers, blow doctors, and they were described as the brother and the sister of the witch because they mixed religion into their practices." Here's another interesting thing. If you really are interested in this kind of subject after this is all over and you haven't had enough, the Kentucky Library is a treasure trove of this kind of material. And it's also of a number of other topics that you can grab hold to, and they're really helpful. I would love to help you with any research you want to do. That's my plug for the Kentucky Library. But they really helped me out. This is from a 1972 interview by Mrs. Welby Thomas about a Mr. Benjamin Judd of Greene County. Mr. Judd had what we call divine healing powers and could remove warts, moles, and other unsightly skin disorders. He learned it from his mother but did not pass it to his daughter due to senility. Mr. Judd would blow into a child's mouth to cure the thrush or thrash. What that is a yeast infection of the mouth, and it can prevent babies from being able to even swallow their food. And many worried parents brought their ailing babies to him. Ms. Thomas also talked about her sister, who had developed smallpox at the age of two, and it became so bad that the doctors had given her up. Mr. Judd made his decision to try his healing powers on her. She soon recovered, and aside from the scars, made a complete recovery. Finally, here's an email that I received this past week from a software engineer who works for the federal government in Washington, D.C. A little background on this. This lady had called me. This book has kind of opened the phone lines and email to me from people who are seeking some sort of assistance. And I have very strict limits on what I will do for them. But this lady seemed really, she needed some help. She felt like something was in her house and was giving her a lot of problems. So I made a charm for her. We'll talk about that later. Also, I made her a charm to protect her and to give her psychic dreams so that she could discover what was really troubling her. Here's the quote. Your little gift, because I never have charged in 34 years for a single thing I've ever made. You can't. That's a rule. Your little gift has been working overtime. I've had no more visitation, and the house feels clear of the former presence. Another interesting phenomenon, I was walking through the house with the gift in my hand, and it was pulsating, as though it were independently alive, and I was carrying something living and breathing in my hand. I don't get spooked by this stuff anymore. I just accept in amazement what's possible. Welcome to the world of the traditional healer. It's a hidden world. Few people will talk about it. In fact, I had a call from Pennsylvania the other day saying, I can't believe you're going to talk about this. Aren't you afraid? And I said, no, at my age, I've stopped being afraid of what people will think or if they'll think I'm crazy. That's okay. It don't matter. How did I get into this stuff? 34 years ago, I was an undergraduate student in religious studies at the University of South Carolina. I was looking for a novel topic, and I was having lunch with a friend, and I'd been reading anthropological ethnographies, which are accounts of people who go out into and interview tribes or live with them for a while. And I was talking about them, how much I really liked reading them and that I wanted to do something like that. And he said, well, you ought to go down there to Beaufort. I shouldn't do that. You ought to go down there to Beaufort and talk to this old man. He's a root doctor. And I said, oh, what's that? He said, you'll find out. And so he directed me to this old man who turned out to be a charming individual. And down I went. And that began a 3-year process of researching. What happened was I did it as my senior thesis. I gave several talks to local churches, to civic groups, won a scholarship, had a wild time my senior year, and put it in a trunk and said, gosh, that was fun. What in the world am I ever going to do with this now? Except I couldn't put it away. It kept reappearing in my life over and over. It kept representing itself to my life. So finally I thought, why are you fighting with this? Just accept it. This is going to be part of your life. That was a long time ago. The book itself has an interesting history. I met the publisher over dinner at an ALA convention in New Orleans. And he was talking about his wife being Brazilian and being interested in what's called Candomblé. And he said, does anybody know what that is? And I said, yeah, sure, I know what that is. And talked to him a little bit about it. And I told him some of my stories. And he said, I'm trying to get a new line of publishing going. Would you want to write a book? Well, I had a cold chill, mixture of fear, and oh my God, what am I going to do now? So I cranked out in 2 years a nice little ethnographic history of this tradition. Turned it in, he sends it right back. This is not what I want. He said, I want the stories. I want it written in a narrative style. I'd never written in a narrative style before. He said, I want all of this to sell. Then the cat was out of the bag. Pandora's box was open. I had to either give it up or tell the stories. So I decided, what the heck, I'll tell the stories. We'll get this done. Anyway, I'll let you know where this took place. I have this nifty little gizmo. A lot of the research was done in South Carolina. And can you see that little? Mm-hmm. It was done in what's called the Dutch Fork. First part of it, however, was done in what's called the Low Country. And the Low Country in South Carolina is this area along in here, borders the coast. Primarily in this area, right here, in the Beaufort County area. The second part was done in what's called the Dutch or Deutsch Fork, which is this area to the west, northwest of Columbia, principally in Lexington. The second part of this was done in Pennsylvania, or the third, actually the most modern part of it was done in Pennsylvania. In this area right in here, which is Lancaster County, right in here. The last bit, which was done in the 70s, when I was at the University of Virginia, was done in this area of Virginia, in and around Lynchburg. I can't be any more defined for that, and you'll understand why in a few minutes. I'll leave that there. That's fun. What is a healer? What is a shaman? Most people, because I use the term, he wanted a catchy title, I gave him a catchy title. Most people, when they think of shaman, think of this kind of individual. This gentleman is a Ecuadorian shaman. He was actually, now this is fun, he was flown in by the government of Ecuador in 2006 to the World Cup soccer games to rid the field of evil spirits. Now that was quite an expensive and exhaustive kind of thing to do, to bring a shaman in from the Ecuadorian jungles, although I'm sure he had a wonderful time. I realized over a while, whoops, let's go back for a second, that what these people were that I was encountering were actually shamanic in the way that they conducted their practice. They certainly weren't this kind of person. They would not see any connection whatsoever. But they were shamanic in certain ways, in the fact that they healed, they counseled, they interpreted dreams, they did what's called divination, and they did work with what's called the spirit world, something we don't recognize as valid in this culture. Okay, and all of them did this. There are actually two kinds of this kind of healers. There are charmers. Charmers generally were a little aunt, uncle or someone who knew how to do one thing and knew how to take the fire out of a burn. There was a faculty member at WKU, and this book has brought people up to me very quietly, very surreptitiously. I've got a story to tell you about that book of yours. And this faculty member, who's a department head, told me about as a child falling into a face first into a kettle of boiling water. She was severely burned. The doctors told her mother that she would be permanently scarred. Not willing to accept that, the mother took her to Auntie so-and-so, who laid the baby in her lap and blew across her face. And within 2 days, there was no burn. There was no scars. There was no anything. Your complexion is beautiful. What is all this? Is it folklore? Is it superstition? Could it be magic? And I would say it's all of these, but it's a whole lot more. It's a form of community wisdom that is passed at a very intimate level between people within communities. It's the kind of wisdom that deals very directly with intimate issues of life, birth, death, madness, sorrow, all of those things for which modern scientific rationalism sometimes isn't a lot of help. Need an example? Look at hospitals now. And in the midst of all the sterile laboratories and operating rooms, the supply chaplain will come around. They will supply chapel often. Now, theoretically and rationally, this shouldn't be necessary if we all accept the rational explanation that science offers us. And I would say that while I think most people do, myself included, I think there are also times in life when a child is desperately ill and there's no hope. That's when it steps out of that realm, into a realm where you need someone to come in and intercede. And a minister does a marvelous job, for the most part, in hospitals. But I would also say that in many times, he's behaving shamanically. He comes in, and in many cases, depending on the denomination, they lay hands on this person. They raise their arms to do an invocation. These are all magical practices. We don't look at them that way. We don't identify them that way, but this is magic. Shamanism. This is three of the definitions that I used for this book. And this one, I think, is particularly, this is Miranda Aldhouse Green. A British scholar, in The Quest for the Shaman. She first tells you that the word is a Siberian Tungus word. It simply means the ecstatic one. But she says, shamanism is not even a religion as such, but rather a worldview system, and this is very important, or a grammar of the mind. There's another excellent definition here. It says, a shaman is a person who enters into controlled alternate states of consciousness, no matter which alternate states these may be. And they do it to contact a non-ordinary reality in order to gain knowledge, power, or to help other persons. Those are great definitions because they all apply to the people that I met in my studies. They would slip out of normal consciousness in order to do a healing. They would slip out of normal consciousness to go find a missing person. In 2003, I said I wasn't going to tell a lot of stories, but I'm going to do it anyway. I was outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania, visiting a powwow family. That's a tradition we'll talk about. They were German, as they called themselves, Dutchies. Wonderful people. Laid out a spread of food that just was, and I love food. It was just heaven. While there were a lot of people there who'd come to meet me for some reason, a little child was playing on the picnic table and fell, busted that child's lip wide open. Well, it let out with a scream. The mother came, grabbed her up, was trying to daub the bleeding. In walks the father. I look at him, and he's in trance already. He walks over, and he says, may I help her? And the mother just goes, and the baby's, he raises his arm up like this. Her eyes roll back in her head, and she goes away. At that point, I go, I can see this. So I walk over. He was completely unaware of my presence at this point. But he had her up. Her lips are here. He was like this. And he begins to chant, Haila, Haila, Niko, Dre. Within 15 seconds, the bleeding stopped. Skin formed over it. And it was like she'd never been injured. And I thought, then he backs off. Oh, by the way, Haila, Haila, Niko, Dre. Heal it, chicken shit. It's a very famous charm from the powwow book that I'll show you for dealing with cuts and bruises, which brings out an important thing. The words themselves are not important. The words are a vehicle for the human energy. And I'm going to talk this evening from a shaman's point of view, from this tradition's point of view, not from an objective scholar. I'm going to tell you as they would tell you. That's how it worked. Well, she's still lying there in his arms. He comes out of trance. I see his eyes change back. He blows in her face. She comes to, and he goes, "Are you all right, baby?" And she goes, he puts her down on the floor, and off she goes. She's still bloody, but that was it. And he looks over at me and goes, "Is that okay?" Yeah, it was. That's one of the things that I encounter over and over, over, over again in this research, and it's in the book, is the miraculous. And if there's one message in this whole book, I'll go ahead and tell you. The miraculous is that the miraculous is still available to us, even in this postmodern industrial age. The miraculous has never been out of our reach. We've been told it is, but I'm here to tell you there's a whole world of people out there for whom it's not. Anyway, that's enough of that. Let's get into the traditions. The first one is called, how did I find these folks? I just told you. We're going to talk about hoodoo and conjure. First of all, hoodoo and conjure are traditions that developed in the Southeast primarily, although it is very prevalent in Texas. It's very prevalent in areas like Chicago, and I'll tell you how it got there, and New York. It's not voodoo. Voodoo is a separate tradition that developed outside the Protestant South as a result of the syncretism of Roman Catholic beliefs with African tradition. Conjure, or hoodoo, and they're used simultaneously, is more actually authentically African. It is animistic, it's spirit-oriented. It's very much dealing with very practical matters. It doesn't have any of the group rituals that voodoo does. It doesn't have the gods that voodoo does, and none of the iconography. Where I'm from, people who practice this are called root doctors, but they're also called conjure doctors, two-headed doctors, which gets into the concept of having a dual soul. This is why, if you will see, if you go into the low country of South Carolina, and it's still done. When a grave is laid, they'll lay seashells all over it. That's because half the soul goes to heaven, and half the soul goes to the river, goes into water, and can walk around and deal with you with that belief. In fact, there is a tombstone out in Fairview Cemetery that's covered in seashells. Woo! Wonder what that's about. And it's an old tomb. Hoodoo is a form of natural magic. By the way, this is a famous doctor from the 1930s, a root doctor. They're very ordinary people. Charmers and root doctors always work together. They had a very strange and sort of tenuous relationship with their community, as all of these shamans did. They were considered very necessary, very practical to have around. However, if something went wrong in the community, they easily became a scapegoat. And if they were caught doing bad things, judgment could be very swift and very certain. And get this, unlike a lot of the sort of the New Age stuff that is handed around today, this is dead serious. People do lose their lives over this kind of stuff. This little lady's kind of fun, but I'll go back. The doctors in and around the Carolinas used animal names for their magical names. They would be called Dr. Eagle, who was named P.C. Washington. Talk about a man that could look right through you. There was also Dr. Hawk, Dr. Crow, who was a woman. This is a place where men and women were absolutely equal, as in the magical sphere. The most famous, though, was a man called Dr. Buzzard, who worked in St. Helena Island. He was absolutely a power unto himself. He's still revered today. This is his common-law wife. Her name is Minerva, and she's protected now. She works too. She's actually mentioned in that book called The Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. She does spells for one of the lawyers. Dr. Buzzard was famous for doing this kind of stuff. He would show up in the courtroom, sit down with his eyes on the witness, start to chew the root, and the witness would go absolutely to pieces. Couldn't testify, couldn't do anything. And they couldn't prosecute him. He wasn't doing anything. Dr. Buzzard is now in an unmarked grave. He died in 1947. He's had many people take his name. These names travel from person to person, but they keep his grave a very closely guarded secret because his bones would be very valuable. This is the person I dealt with. His name was J.E. McTeer, James Edwin McTeer. This is an old picture of him. I couldn't get this picture scanned. This is him when I knew him. I'll just pass that around. He was a high sheriff of the Lowcountry, and he learned very quickly, because he'd been taught on the plantation about conjuring, that he could use this in his law work. After all, this was quite a while ago, and you could do stuff like that legally. He could move within communities. He could get information from people, because he became known for this kind of work. He had an office, a real estate office, with a secret room in the back. and that was his altar room. And this is his altar. He was in his 70s when I met him. He still had a very powerful presence. He called himself a poor man's psychiatrist, but that didn't mean he thought it was all in people's heads. He had people that came hundreds of miles. We had a woman, when I was there one time, that rode in from Wisconsin. Her butler came to the door and said, you know, may I bring this individual in? He brought him in. We took her back to the room. I sat down. He began to work on her once he talked to her. I'm going to stop for a second and talk about the things he did. He created charms. These are root charms or roots. They're really insignificant in and of themselves. It's what they represent and what's been invested in them in terms of energy. But all of these traditions have something called basic concepts of magic and how magic works. There are two types of folk magic. There's sympathetic, which is based on the idea of like creates like, or an effect resembles its cause. Therefore, you do little symbolic things towards a symbol of the individual, usually with something that belongs to that individual in that charm that you're making, as you're working upon. An example, of course, would be the poppet. Does everyone know what I mean about a poppet? The other form of magic that is done, especially in conjurers, called contagious magic. And that's based on the idea that once something has come in contact with you, it's connected to you always by a thin stream of energy. It's also a way of setting the trick, as they say in the conjure world. It's to have something laid at your doorstep. You come out in the morning, you step on it, and it infects you. That's contagious magic. Another example of that is the witch bottle. Here's a poppet from England. I like this one because somebody would be really mad at somebody. This is 19th century from Cornwall. And there again, you're acting against this person indirectly. All of this stuff, as Mr. McTeer would say, they're all just props. He said, people expect a show, so I have the big thing on the wall. He said, it doesn't mean a thing. He said, but they want a show because that puts them in a more receptive place to receive what I'm about to give them. This is a witch bottle, very commonly used. This one, again, somebody didn't like somebody a lot. This thing had nails, pins, little pieces of cloth, which I'm sure belonged to it, and it was put under the boards of a house in Maryland, shoved up under there as a way of placing a curse in the house. This is 19th century. They find this stuff when they're doing renovations. In all the traditions we're talking about magically based healing, and the primary role of all of these people we're talking about was healing. We're talking about a different conception of illness. We're talking about, of course, natural injuries, natural illness. That's your viruses, that's your stomach ache, that's your just regular stuff. Spiritual illness. This was very common belief in the stuff I read in the Kentucky Library. This was a very common belief. You transgress morally, God does something to you to respond, gives you illness as a response. When I used to come home in the 1960s from a long weekend of having a good time, quite assuredly say this was a result of my moral transgression. She was right. The last form is a very serious form, and that's the magic. And this is my term for it: a magical intrusion. And this is illness or harm caused by an intrusive magical projection from some person or some thing, some entity. Therefore, in all of the cases and all of the people that I've dealt with over the years, the first thing to do is determine what are we dealing with. I just put this together yesterday, so bear with me. There is always the same process in magical healing. You interview the person, and if you're a good healer, you listen. You listen and you interpret the subtleties of what they're saying, because that's going to give you the information about what's happening to this individual. You prepare the subject to be receptive. You help them relax. Then you sit back and you interpret what they've heard. You interpret what's going on. And I always tell people, this is from a shamanic healing course that I've done. Then you examine their energy field, and they all do this. They'll move the hands above the individual, sometimes a few inches, but there's absolutely no need to touch people. And you're feeling for irregularities in their energy field, because everyone is surrounded by an energy field that they produce. Some people call it an aura. I never heard that term until way on. I never heard a traditional healer use it. It's just their energy. And when you're scanning them, you're feeling for something that doesn't feel right. You scan the healthy part of the person first, then you work your way through them, and you can feel when something's wrong. Ideally. Then you choose a technique to work with them. These are techniques for a magical intrusion. You can use incantations. One of the most effective is water. Water is believed to break all negative or psychic energy. So one of the things that healers will do is they'll bathe the person. They'll wash their face, especially if you've got somebody who's undergoing possession. You will oftentimes put salt in that water, because salt, there again, breaks up the psychic energy. You will also if you find a magical intrusion, a form of magical intrusion, where somebody has placed something in the house, you'll plunge it into salt water. That's done in the powwow tradition, and it's done in the conjure tradition. You also help them secure their area psychically. I had a call from Quebec, Canada, about a month ago. Was it a month ago? This poor soul was in rather dreadful straits. She felt she had something that was really oppressing her, and she'd heard about the book and had called. When everyone calls me like this, I don't judge. I take them at their face value. I listen very carefully. I have a long conversation with them to try and figure out whether I've got somebody who has a genuine need or feels they have a genuine need, or someone who's just 5 cans short of a six-pack. Sorry, that's a mean way to say it. But not dealing with their normal rationality very well. This person seemed to have a real situation going. So I told her to secure her bed. Your bed is where is believed you're most vulnerable. It's when you're asleep. And she was being scratched while she was asleep. Her daughter got on the phone and told me that she had watched scratches appear on her mother's arms while she was sitting watching television. That's pretty typical. That's typical stuff. So you use the iron and the salt to disrupt the negative energy. Then you start moving out through the house. And you secure the entire dwelling. Fortunately, I always recommend baths in Epsom salt water. If there's always something I always use when I talk with these people, is a Latin phrase my mother always used. Primum non no care. First of all, do no damage. So none of this, including the Epsom salts bath, is going to hurt this person. And if it helps them, all the better. I did get a follow-up call. A lot of times you don't get follow-up calls, but I got a follow-up call. This person apparently is okay now. The house has gotten normalized. Everything feels right. This lady is a hospital administrator. She works at a very high level. So it's unusual, and yet not unusual. You use herbs, you use charcoal oils, but then you do your healing. You clean and balance the person, because all shamanic healing is holistic. It is holistic in that it treats the whole person, not just the body, not what you do with the emotions, the spirit as well. So you want to leave the person completely intact when you leave. Then afterwards, especially if you're dealing with a magical intrusion, you got to clean yourself. You got to neutralize all the energy around yourself that may have gotten on you, because sometimes this kind of stuff is very infectious. I've been very lucky. What do? You've got magic words, magic actions, and magic object. All three are universal to all of this. I'm going to jump back. Let's talk powwow. This is the tradition I most became involved in. And most of us know very little about this, because there again, it's hidden. Most of us know this version of it. There's a little hex signs. And you'll get people that swear up and down this has absolutely nothing to do with any form of magic. It's all just decoration. Then why pay people to do this? But this is what you have to do in the modern world. The person that I worked with called them painted prayers. What you're doing is you're pushing your personal energy into this geometric design. You're thereby setting up a symbol that will grow, and you'll give it energy each day for a while, and it'll protect you. Now, in South Carolina, they did not paint barns. That's almost universally a Pennsylvania phenomenon. And it really didn't take popular hold until the 1940s. It was done before, as far back as the 1830s. This is an 1830s Pisate, though, from Lexington, South Carolina. As you can see, it has the basic hex rosettes, which are protective. This would be setting up a protective barrier for your food. Quite a very practical thing to do. The man I was around was this gentleman here, Lee Rouse Gandy. He was a native of West Virginia. He was born into a powwow family. Actually, his grandmother adopted him. He was a retired history professor, highly educated. He was a genealogist. He would do this for people. He lived in a marvelous little... He was also a bottle collector, in case you can't tell. And he collected arrowheads. This is an interesting thing. He lived immersed in a world of magic, in a world of spirits. He lived almost in another reality. And to be around this man for any period of time would draw you into this world, to the point that you would start to have the experiences he was having. Now, was it hypnosis? I don't know. But I can tell you there's some marvelous things used to happen, and it really upset me when I was young, because it ain't supposed to happen. It's not rational. It's not supposed, this is just all in people's minds. But it does happen. And this is what I mean by, he used to get really angry and say, why have we cut the miraculous out of our life? Why have we forced this out? You can't even talk about a religious miracle anymore without people going, you must be a little odd. And yet, year after year, people come to me and telling me these stories. Every one of us is experiencing the miraculous, hopefully. And all I'm saying is, it's a sad thing that it's poo-pooed.
You remember that bottle you said something that was interesting?
That bottle contained, he loved the folklore of the Lexington Dutch Fork. That bottle contained an evil spirit. It was sealed up and had been sealed up since the 1860s. And as the time he was sitting there, he hands it over to him and said, "Why don't you uncap it?" I respectfully declined. Even in that hot room, that bottle was ice cold. And to hold it was creepy. Now, power of suggestion? Of course, that's one explanation for what was going on. I understand. This is a better picture of him. This is when he was a teacher. And this is one of his things from his book called Strange Experience, Secrets of Hex and Miser. His great-grandfather was a hex, which is his term for it. And if you're reading this, you've got to be careful when you have the power to weather witch. And he brought about his own demise by yelling at the lightning. This is the little book that's was published first in 1820 in Berks County, in Pennsylvania. It really is a hodgepodge of book of medieval folklore, incantations, and little spells. It's come back into print, which is interesting. This copy is from the 1820s. I bought mine from a curio supply house in 1974. It's called The Long-Lost Friend. It is found all over Pennsylvania, all over the Carolinas and the Dutch Fork. People treasure them. Okay, we've been through this. There's one thing, I'll flash this up to give you a chance to read. Being a historian, Mr. Gandy, or Lee as I called him, was fascinated with where all this came from, as I became fascinated. He believed that it came from the old religions of Europe, pre-Christian. I'll read you a little piece. I'm just jumping all over the place. From John Hawkins, who was a writer in 1907 in Popular Science Monthly, entitled Magical Medical Practice in South Carolina. As of that day in 1907, people of the German settlement of South Carolina still held to their traditional beliefs in healing and traced these beliefs to their pre-Christian origins. Heathen formulas used to cure the disease, the only change affected by Christianity was the substitution of the three highest names, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, for those of Thor, Woden, and the heathen deities. This is what's called the Second Merseburg Charm. It's very famous, and it's one of the ones that you can clearly see, and that's why I put it up here. You can clearly see the transition from a pagan incantation, Baldur's Coat, Fol and Woden, Fua and Walla, down to a Christian version. And this is the one that the folks in the Fork would use. Our Lord rode his foot, Fol's foot slayed, down he lighted his Fol foot righted, bone to bone, sinew to sinew, flesh to flesh, heal in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. You insert the name right there. But that shows how this stuff moves. There were also many magical tools for a shaman. This is Mr. Gandhi's throw stick. A throw stick is a stick carved from one piece of wood with a snake on it. And it's, if you want to know where it came from, it developed out of the whole thing of Moses' rod in Egypt. That's where it came from. And a shaman would send his throw stick out to get information. The other thing, and you can't see it well, so I'll take mine out, is a holy stone. A holy stone was a protective amulet. They were used for healing, but they were most likely a protection. You nod your head, I can see you've heard of all this. There was also an extensive use of certain signage. This is called a Petschaft or Wundesiegel, and it was used, it was actually drawn on the person's chest to draw fever out with the soot from a fireplace. And as you can tell, it's got a whole range of little combination of Christian and other sorts of symbols. This little piece right here is the eye of God, because God is where you start all hex signs. You start, and if you ever create one, you slip into trance and you create from the center out. So all the hex signs are created from the center out. This is called the Seder Magic Square, Setar Rotas Square. This first time they found archaeologically that this dates back to Herculaneum. It was found on a wall there. It has been found in Chichester, England, and dates to the 3rd century A.D. It's a protective piece. You would see these inside barns, doors. You would see them, and they're all discreetly put so that, you know, I mean, this is not something you advertise. It's all done very discreetly. But this was also used to stop fire. Here's another look at the hole stones. Now, this was in England. There's a whole ritual of passing people through a hole stone in England. It was done in this part, in this country as well. However, it transferred in this country to the horse collar. Babies with certain illnesses would be passed through the horse collar. And there's an account of it in the city of Newberry, South Carolina. What that would do, magically, it was believed that that would draw the energy away from the individual as it passed through, as the person passed through. So there was the personal size and the very large size. As I said, how does this all work? Illness can be almost seen as personified. And if you can personify illness, you can drive it out. Okay? The hex, the powwow, the conjure doctor all have the ability to slip into trance almost at the blink of an eye. It takes a lot of practice to do this. Most of the people began with prayer. And that's one thing we really have to bring out, is all of the people we're talking about, Mr. Gannon would sometimes use the word witch, but most of them saw themselves as devout Christians. The lady from Appalachia that I've talked about, I'm going to talk about, gave all her power to Jesus. And this is how I do what I do. I could not do this if Jesus didn't let me. Mr. McTeer was the same way. These were all very good Christian, very devout spiritual people. Some of the most spiritual people I've ever met. Here's a little thing that I found sort of significant. The majority of these people lived in the rural areas. Still do. I started to understand that perhaps part of that was part of how they were able to develop what they have. They weren't as nearly as distracted. If they watched TV, I never saw them do it. But their houses were simple. They lived a simple, very connected life. And somehow I think that isolation, that contact on a daily basis with nature, somehow may have opened up some level of their consciousness that perhaps our living in our distracted world we're cut off from, or cut ourselves off from. The last tradition is the Appalachian granny tradition. Appalachian, when we think of Appalachia today, we think of beautiful mountains. We think of the scenic vistas and the drives across the Smokies that we just went over in the rain to visit my mother. It was, for many, many decades, over 100 years, a very isolated area. Early colonists for South Carolina and for Virginia, a lot of them fled into the mountains. They fled things like what's called the indenture system. The indenture system was a form of slavery that was inflicted on a lot of people. It was a cruel system. A lot of the people who were Scots and Scots-Irish were brought here under dreadful conditions in what were called coffin ships, where about half of them would die on the way over. When they got here, they weren't accepted because you had a primarily, especially in the Carolinas, you had this very English society along the Lowcountry. I see you nodding your head. It was the same in Georgia, wasn't it? But they weren't accepted. What happened with the powwow people? They were brought from Germany as a barrier between the Indians up in the mountains and the Lowcountry plantations. They were brought in from, they recruited them actively throughout Europe, brought them in, got them to settle, and then forgot about them, ignored them completely through most of the colonial period. It's very odd because during the Revolutionary War, the Hessian troops came through that part of South Carolina, ran into these people who spoke beautiful German, and deserted almost en masse. After all, they were mercenaries. A lot of these people, though, that fled even further into the mountains knew that no one would chase them once they got past a certain point. And if they survived the Indians, who weren't real happy about them being there, they probably could build a world that was basically their own. This is where we get the word like red legs, hillbillies, crackers. All these were derisive terms for these people. They brought with them, though, the isolation and did one other thing. It caused them to look back into their own ancestry for what worked. They had to help themselves. And I remember my father telling me there was one sheriff for a 150-mile radius. Now, that was a really effective law enforcement. So they took care of their own, as he said. They brought with them a tradition called the Cunning Man tradition. And this is a fascinating tradition. If you want to read something very interesting, read about this tradition in England. Oops, that didn't work. What did I do? Thank you. The Cunning Man tradition in England has been in the air for a long time. This is a man named James Cunning Morrell. He was, during his time, which was 1700s, he was known all over England. People traveled from all over the British Isles to visit this man. He was a healer. He talked to the spirits. He was world-renowned. His box of tools was kept in a museum, and is still there. This is a 1940s Cunning Man. His name was Norman Gills. Same tradition, same practices. This is the lady I met, and I call her Sarah Ramsey. That's not her name. She was from rural Virginia. And this is about dead on what she looked like, though. People have always asked me, well, you got to show us what she looked like. This is pretty much what she looked like. I met her through her granddaughter, who worked with me at the University of Virginia. And she said, we started talking about my stuff. And she said, oh, my grandma does all this stuff. You want to meet her? So sure enough, we piled into her car and went out there. And this dear little soul came out. She was really too old to be much of a healer anymore. And that brings up a little side. To do this kind of thing takes incredible energy. It takes incredible physical and mental and emotional energy. So as people get older, they're really not as able to get the energy up, so to speak. And they haven't come up with... No, I better not say that. But you know what I'm talking about. She'd had a marvelous... For did it the first day I met her, I brought her daughter. Her daughter was there. Her daughter was very watchful and very protective of her. And she said, you know, whatever you say about Mama, whatever you write about Mama, we're going to have to live with. You have nothing to worry about. I have no intention of ever publishing anything about your mom. And if you do, I won't use her name. So then they all relaxed, and it was kind of like, we're sitting in the yard in those horrible little chairs that they made back then that were just monstrously uncomfortable. And she said, Mom, show them how you do the birds. And Ms. Ramsey reaches up her hand, and a little bird comes out of the tree and lands on her finger, brings it over, talks to it, hey, pretty thing, kissed it. It just sat there. She didn't feed it. She didn't do anything. And then finally she goes, go on now. I saw her do this 3 more times. Not the same bird, all different wild birds, blue jays, wren, robin, and a little sparrow. That first one was a little sparrow. And I was dumbstruck. I started having images of St. Francis of Assisi. And I realized she had somehow, through all the years, she had very minimal education. Mr. Gamby was probably the best educated of all these people that I ever knew. But she had a certain wisdom about her, a presence about her that was very powerful. And you couldn't help but love her. She'd also dealt with negative energy, negative magic. That's also in the book, too. I'm going to keep talking and give a little time for questions. One thing is, I'll explain what this is. We've all incorporated, whether we know it or not, little elements of folk magic into our lives. My mother was in corporate America for 35 years. And one night, she's sweeping up the den. And she gets to the door. She stops. And the door's open to the patio. And I said, sweep it out, Mother. She goes, no. Why? Well, your luck will go out with it. She scoops it up into a pan and throws it in the trash. That was an old belief that you swept out your luck at night in the room. This is a 19th century witch ball. What does it look like?
Christmas ornament.
That's exactly how it morphed. When Albert and Victoria introduced Christmas trees to the Western, to England, and that would have been 1860s. When did she marry? Do you know when she married him?
Late
19th century. They took the witch balls out of the windows because the tree, if you think about it, became symbolic of the family. It became symbolic of the home. They began to hang them on the tree. And of course, now we have a huge industry, and people are completely unaware of what this means and what it meant and why these things were there. The reflective surface, by the way, was to reflect back evil that might come into the house. Mirrors were used the same way. The presence of iron. Have anybody ever seen a horseshoe over a doorway? That's to repel the negative energy that might come through the door. Doorways like crossroads are a very significant place, so you always protect the doorway. And granny women also, and I have to say this, were sometimes the only friend a woman had. Life was hard for women in the mountains. They were expected to probably work as hard, if not harder, than the men. Everybody worked hard, but the woman had additional duties. When she became pregnant, it would send for the granny woman. It's estimated that Ms. Ramsey probably delivered around 400 babies. I learned that my own paternal great-grandmother did this too. And I remember people coming by to pay their respects, which is a southern custom of, and this adult person would walk in and pay their respects to my grandmother, who would smile and talk to them a little bit, and they'd go on. And she had given birth into a child. That was fascinating, that this grown person, she had brought them into the world. They would send all the men out of the house. This was not the place where men belonged. And here's what was interesting. The granny woman, by and large, would clean the house, clean the sheets, set the whole place up. Think about what she was doing. They'd learned this all rote, no medical books, no anything, but they knew somehow if the place was clean, there was a whole lot less chance of the woman developing a septic reaction to the birth. And there are accounts of granny women who birthed 400 or 500 children and never lost one. That is something even any medical person would envy. She was also considered an elder in the community. She would also evaluate the baby at birth, which was kind of interesting. That was sort of when the magic started to move into the equation. And if the baby was born with a caul or a membrane over its face, this was a clear sign that this baby was destined for magic. They read signs, omens, they could talk fire, stop bleeding, all the little things that a healing person does. So there you have it in a nutshell. These traditions are still alive, and I think they're actually growing. I've met people in Tennessee. I've met people here in Kentucky. I've met people everywhere in Ohio. So I was telling them, this was always taught cross-gender. Any sort of magical training was taught cross-gender. And this woman came up to me in Ohio and said, I've been mad at my mother for 40 years because she wouldn't teach me this stuff. She taught my brother, and I thought she just didn't like me. So now, for the first time, I understand why she wouldn't teach me. But it's still alive because I think it serves a really basic human need. And that's, if you want to explain it as a psychologist, to be empowered, to feel empowered. Thank you for listening. I hope it's been fun for you all. It certainly made a lasting impression on my life. I hardly sometimes have words to describe it. And what I think it really, if anything, it opens a window and gives you a glimpse of a world of possibility that I think we all probably need to embrace. And I won't get preachy now. But your world and your reality can be so much more than you ever dreamed it can be. And I think it appeals to me because these were all solitary. in nature. By and large, they're solitary traditions. They're concerned with everyday issues of life and death. But they offer you a chance to move without intoxication, without drugs, without anything else, beyond the normal realms of your regular consciousness. People do it all the time. They do it through prayer. They do it through meditation. I was watching some folks engaged in ballet practice. I could see it in their eyes. These people were in another state of consciousness. And that's what we're really talking about here. We're talking about additional states of consciousness that we ignore or we don't recognize. And I would say those states of consciousness oftentimes offer us a look into a world that's endless and wonderful and can be sometimes give you a glimpse of the divine, if I may be so bold. Anyway, does anybody have any questions? Yes, ma'am.
You were talking about breaking the or healing, what wasn't right around the person,
right.
Moving hands around the person, not touching them, but just being close.
That's a diagnostic tool.
But isn't it true that as a being, we each have a gravitational force?
Oh, yeah.
And that we have a magnetic field?
Yes.
Are they not detecting that?
Sure they are. Okay. And if you're looking for irregularities in it, you must have realized also that unlike the scourge of anthropology is that a researcher goes native. Well, I went native a long time ago. The person, I actually did a healing in Missouri before we left. A man called me and said, my wife has an ovarian tumor. Can you please come and do that thing you do? Now, if you practice powwow, you can't say no. Not on that very sincere way. So I went. And there was another healer there who did a crystal healing. And I sat and I waited. She finished. And I'm sure did a fine job. Then I leaned over this lady and I said, sister, if I am to heal you, remember it's not that I heal. I'm not I who heal you. It is only the divine that heals you. Therefore, you need never pay me and you certainly don't even have to thank me. Because if this works, I can try. All I can do is try. So then I began to set. She was lying on a couch and I started to work over her about 3 inches off. I closed my eyes because I'd already slipped into trance. At one point, Pat, I felt something really dark and really ugly. Yes, I opened my eyes and it was right over her abdomen. And I thought to myself, well, young man, now you've gotten yourself in a situation. What are you going to do? And I thought, I started praying very hard. And in the prayer, I heard back that it feeds on her blood. Choke it. So I started to do the powwow chant for stopping the blood. And I did it until I knew it was stopped. And I worked. I visualized the tumor. And I moved around it as I chanted. At the end, I felt like something, I was finished. I couldn't do anymore. I was absolutely gone in terms of my energy. What happens in a powwow is the belief that you open up as a, you're nothing, absolutely nothing, but a conduit for divine energy to move through. You have no healing powers in and of yourself. And you can feel it open. Now I'm really getting into it. And as you feel it open, it moves through you. Now, I know what some of you must be thinking. And it's okay. But this is what happened and how it happens. And as I finished, you sweep the person. You don't have to touch them, but you kind of move their energy around till it feels more balanced. Some people I've heard call this Reiki. I've never taken a Reiki course. I don't know anything about it. But I've heard people, oh, that's like Reiki. Then I got physically ill. I had to lie down because I just felt really sick. And when I kind of came out of it, I know we were driving home and Leslie turned to me and said, well, do you think you helped her? And all I could say was, as far as I know, we left her with the feeling of being loved. That there was a whole room full of people who were praying for this person, who were reaching out to this person. And if that can heal, maybe she'll be healed. Well, apparently, about 3 weeks later, the husband called and the tumor had dried up. It has never represented itself. She's still quite healthy today. That's a marvelous, wondrous thing. Did I do it? No. I didn't do any of it. It simply is a factor of the experience. I don't know what happened. Maybe it just spontaneously did it, but something facilitated it. This is what I think healing is based on, is that things can maybe operate at a microscopic level, and that's what a healer does. I've seen, why else would it work on an animal? I saw a dog that had been run over and was clearly crushed, and this fellow got down, this young man who was more talented than I ever was at that age, got down and laid his hands upon it and held it as it whimpered. And a day later, it was up running around. I don't know. This is that marvelous part of life that was opened up. This is that part we say, this just can't be. Then how does this happen? How do these things work? I don't know. I don't have an explanation. I know that something's going on. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah. Jack?
I can sense that you want to move. Just need to try to wait.
No. I'm just moving over to the side.
I have two questions.
Sure.
One has to do with the four elements that you mentioned, water,
yes,
iron, nutrition.
Yes, salt.
And,
salt. Those are just very basic tools that all of them use.
Iron.
I usually tell people put a fry pan under the bed. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's understood and believed that in a psychic sense, iron disrupts. This is why a lot of people bought these old iron beds. They were psychically safe places to sleep.
Your question, where does belief come into this for the person that you are healing? You have a shared belief system with the person you are healing.
Not necessarily.
They came to you for healing. Do I have the same belief system?
No. No, it can actually be done at a distance. And when you're dealing with animals and very small children, they obviously can't be in the same belief system as you are. This is what enchanted me about it, was that I'd always thought, okay, they've got to believe it. You got to all be in sync, and you've got to believe that when the hands are laid, that what's happening is agreed upon for everybody. Apparently not.
How about you?
Oh, absolutely. It's made me a far more religious person than I was when all this started. I was sort of like a very sort of humanistic kind of individual. It was very sort of like, I'll believe it when I see it kind of person. Very cynical, very skeptical. But that changes over time. You just don't see this happen again and again and have it not change you. I would say belief is more important with an adult. And I'll tell you why it's more important. Because we have more barriers in our thinking, more barriers in our consciousness than a child does. A child can see that which we don't see anymore, or we don't recognize anymore. But belief, therefore belief has to becomes the empowering vehicle that can let that energy, allows us to open up and let it happen. Certainly. That's a perfectly synonymous term. Faith is an absolutely essential part of all of this stuff for us, especially for adults. Because it's believed in the powwow tradition that your faith, your religious faith, gives the energy to push it through to a child. Or as Mr. Gandhi would, when you dehorn a cow, you know, they'll bleed like crazy sometimes. And he would just lay his hand out there and it would instantly stop. He would do it over the phone. They'd call and I'd get his, Lee, got this cow, won't stop bleeding. How old is it? What's its name? And he'd begin to chant. A few minutes, you'd hear, thank you. Now, obviously, his faith was unshakable. People with unshakable faith have always been able to do marvelous things. People with no questioning of their belief can do marvelous things. This is why, you know, we sometimes laugh at these people. And there are a lot of charlatans out there. There are a lot of con men. That's why I always tell, if somebody charges you for this, it's a con. This is always given freely, because what else is given freely? Divine love. Therefore, I've never taken a penny for anything in 34 years. Never will. I make the charms at my expense. I mail them to him. I had a couple that came up. Oh, this is one of those things where poor Leslie, God bless her, she's put up with a lot with this. And we're in Ohio. Tennessee, I'm sorry. It's in Tennessee. And we're at camping. And we're sitting around with couples and we're talking. And I start golfing my stuff. And I see this very conventional looking couple standing at the edge of the crowd. And I thought, because they look so straight-laced, forgive me that term, that they, when they came up, they were about to give me a big lecture. But the man walks up to me and says, sir, can you please help us? And right then I knew something else was going on. And I said, how may I serve you? And he says, we are under a curse. And he starts to tell me all this stuff. And it had all the markings of a true situation. So I listened, and his wife was the focus of this curse. So I sat there. I thought, well, don't have anything to give them or make for them, but I laid my hands on both of them. We said a prayer. We linked arms. I did what I could to drive off that which surrounded them. I told them how to secure their home, how to secure their bed, what to take the baths, and I said, I will mail you a charm, a protective charm. And I did. And I watched them. They went off to this incredible, turns out these people ran their own winery and were very successful because they had one of these humongous buses that you could live in, RV, recreational vehicles. So he came back, he tried to give me a case of wine. The best I would do is I would share a glass of them with them over dinner. That's as far as I would go with it. But apparently they're okay now. Now, you know, am I doing this, or is this some kind of a complex grammar of the mind that is allowing them to do what they could do anyway. Very possibly. Very possibly. This is what's actually happening. And what you're talking about with the charms and all is a placebo effect. That would be one way to explain all of this. That would be a way that makes everybody feel very comfortable.
But with that, I'm going to cause a pause in the action. I want to thank Jack.